Welcome to the Source Podcast, powered by WHYY News and Billy Penn. This collection of stories from the WHYY Newsroom offers fresh insights into the neighborhoods and local communities across the Philadelphia region. From Center City to the Pennsylvania suburbs, South Jersey, and Delaware, get to know the issues and the people that make your community tick. This is The Source. I'm your host, Kenny Cooper. Our region has seen more smoke blow in from wildfires in Canada again this summer. But the Philadelphia region itself is not immune from wildfire. New Jersey alone experiences on average 1,100 wildfires each year, burning 5,000 acres. To spot these fires, the state uses a century-old system. 21 fire towers where fire observers spend 8 hours a day watching for smoke. From WHYY News' climate desk, Susan Phillips takes us to the Pine Lands, one of the most fire-prone areas of the country.
We're at the Medford Fire Tower at the edge of the Wharton State Forest in the Pine Barrens of South Jersey. And we're going to climb up the tower today and check out and see what one of those observers does for his job. So let's take a look.
Almost there.
After climbing the metal staircase 100 feet high, I reach a trap door.
And then just stand here and we'll close this door so we can all spread out.
Nice office. So. Beautiful view.
Yeah, it's awesome. So right now you're viewing southwestern Burlington County.
Brian Gerber Jr. is a forest fire observer for the New Jersey Forest Fire Service. He sits up here 8 hours a day, all alone, looking for smoke. For Gerber, it runs in the family. His father works in the Forest Service, and he grew up across the street from this fire tower.
That little hill over there would be Apple Pie Hill. So the Mullica River runs this way and...
How far can we see? Like, how many miles is that?
You could probably see close to 20 miles, but the human eye, we like to say a good 10 miles radius in the tower on a perfectly clear day.
And I just realized I can see the city. I can see Philadelphia skyline here.
Yep.
From Gerber's perch 100 feet in the air, turkey vultures buzz by the windows that line all four sides. Gazing down, the tops of the tallest pitch pines and oak trees are about 30 feet below. Inside, it's pretty cramped, just 7 by 7 feet. But he managed to lug a comfortable leather chair, an air conditioner, and a microwave up 150 exposed metal stairs. Each morning, one of the first things Gerber does is check the weather with headquarters.
You can go ahead and send it, Cedar Bridge.
Relative humidity, temperature, precipitation, and wind are four key weather factors that determine forest fire risk.
Our leaf litter is very dry, so if someone might accidentally throw a cigarette out their window, it could start a fire on a very dry day.
Looking down from the top of the tower, you can see the roofs of suburban homes that sit right next to this forest.
The most important part is to protect property and people. A lot of these homes are in the wildland-urban interface.
The wildland-urban interface is where development meets forests. And it's growing across the U.S., putting more people at risk of having to flee their homes. These fire towers have given people advanced warning for more than a century, using tools that date back to the founding of the state's Forest Fire Service in 1906.
Wind direction, northwest.
Gerber's tower office is dominated by a large circular wooden table that is about 4 feet in diameter. Glued on top of the table is a detailed map of the 20-mile radius that can be seen from the tower. And around the circular map are 360-degree compass readings. This is called an alidade, the earliest of which was likely invented in the 4th century. A rifle scope is attached to spot the exact degree of the smoke. The entire contraption is called an Osborne firefinder, invented back in 1911.
So if you saw a smoke, I would use this tool right here to pinpoint it, and I would get a degree reading out of 360 degrees of a circle, and I would call another fire tower and see if they could see the smoke and get their degree reading, and I'd use my map, and we would cross it out like triangulation.
From the ceiling, he unlatches a wooden board. Glued to it is a map of the entire state, plotted with all 21 fire towers.
So I would use the crosshairs in the scope to pinpoint where the smoke is. And then say that I was crossing a smoke with Apple Pie Fire Tower, we could pinpoint exactly where it is, where the X marks the spot of where the fire is.
It's very old school, but it's very cool.
About half of all forest fires are detected by observers like Gerber. The other half are called into 911. So I asked him, with all the new technology, including drones and AI, why does the Forest Service stick with the low tech?
You can use all the high tech stuff, but it could be false readings. Like you could be going to 100 barbecue pits in someone's backyard. We're supposed to be up here reading the smoke, and we should be watching the smoke. If it's growing and it's got color, it could be a forest fire. But if it's a white little puff, we'll monitor it all day. But we're not just going to send a fire warden to a bunch of barbecues. We want it to actually be a fire.
As Gerber said, he's trained to read smoke. He says in the Pine Barrens, a forest fire starts out as a dense column of gray smoke and may become gray and white.
It's not wispy like a barbecue pit. A forest fire always continues to grow and the column expands.
Gerber says if he sees smaller columns of smoke all lined up in a row along a road, it's likely a driver whose car is backfiring, lighting up the brush at equal intervals. He's spotted similar fires caused by freight trains along railroad tracks. Whatever it is, he says, 99% of the state's forest fires are caused by humans.
So it could be someone lighting fireworks in their backyard, like 4th of July. It could be someone mowing their lawn and the leaves underneath their mower catch on fire.
All of this, he says, still needs human eyes and experience to send out the proper warning. And for Gerber, he says he couldn't have a better job.
I just love the view. It changes every morning you come up here. It's always such a gorgeous view. You can see the Pine Barrens this way. And on a crystal clear day, you could see smoke almost anywhere in the state and in our division.
From 100 feet above the Wharton State Forest, I'm Susan Phillips, WHYY News.
The ongoing shortage of ADHD medications continues to affect patients in our region. Pharmacists and doctors say that despite some government action to address the problem, it can still be a struggle for patients to get the medicine they need. WHYY's Alan Du has more.
Madison Blank, who lives in Philadelphia, has been taking ADHD medication since she was diagnosed 5 years ago. But a little over a month ago, she called her pharmacy to pick up her prescription, and the pharmacist said they were out of stock. She called other pharmacies and got the same answer. She experienced depressive episodes and energy crashes, which can happen when an ADHD patient suddenly goes without their medication.
I can manage, but it's energy consuming, you know? So by the end of the day, it's just like you're spent because you're really just working all day to like keep yourself on track.
She turned to her doctor for help.
What my doctor did was basically put in scripts for 3 different stimulant medications, and we basically just played the lottery to see which one will get filled first.
She finally got some medication, but it's a type that she's not used to, so she is still adjusting to the effects. The shortage comes down to the demand for ADHD medication being bigger than the supply, says Rob Frankel, a pharmacist and the executive director of the Philadelphia Association of Retail Druggists, which represents community pharmacies. He says the problem is that because the medication is a controlled substance, the federal government sets limits on how much manufacturers can make. At the same time, there are also limits of how many controlled substances each pharmacy can sell. So when a desperate patient calls different pharmacies to find ADHD medication, the pharmacy might have more in stock, but those are already reserved for existing patients.
So then that leads to the issue of the perception of the shortage being bigger than it actually is.
He says the federal government has recently increased the manufacturing limit for ADHD medication, but it does not mean that companies have immediately responded by making more medicine. Alan Yu, WHYY News.
It seems like this summer has been one big party in Philly as a big focal point for America's 250th birthday. But there was a much different celebration here when the city was the center of British rule and occupied by the British Army in 1778. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports on how the British had a lot of fun in Philly.
The British marched into Philadelphia on September 26, 1777, and without a single shot fired, took over the largest city in the American colonies. They had just had a grueling but decisive victory at Brandywine, and the British officers were ready for a little R&R.
There's dances, there's balls, there's horse racing, there's a great deal of gambling, there are parties, there's a major theater scene.
Aaron Sullivan is the author of The Disaffected, Britain's Occupation of Philadelphia During the American Revolution.
A lot of money in the British officer class, and there is a lot of pent-up demand from the elite people of Philadelphia who've at this point been cut off from British trade for years. It's a high time.
The occupation was not a high time for everybody. Food and basic essentials were in short supply. Many lower and middle class residents suffered. But the British pulled into their social sphere Philadelphia's well-heeled class for dancing and parties. The officers even put on amateur theater productions in South Philadelphia.
This is my theory about what they were mainly doing. They were there to meet girls.
Peter Schmitz is an actor and author of Adventures in Theater History Philadelphia, the book and the podcast. He says the British made Philly more fun than it had been before.
They made it a place where partying and dancing and theater became the norm in the social sphere, which it hadn't been up till then. The original Continental Congress had outlawed theaters and gaming and horse races and cockfights and all those things that the British officers, who were mainly from the aristocracy, loved to do.
The revelry of the British Army in Philadelphia culminated in a massive party in May 1778 called the Meschianza, which was literally the party to end all parties. The highly theatrical medieval pageant, lavish dinner, and all-night ball for hundreds of guests was thrown on the occasion of British General William Howe's removal as commander. It was a final blowout before the army evacuated Philadelphia. Caroline O'Connell, a curator at the American Philosophical Society, says the Meschianza was performative of an empire on the brink of collapse.
Things in the war are starting to shift. The announcement of the alliance, the American alliance with the French, has just made its way across and almost immediately impacts the course of the war. So there is this sense that it's sort of a last gasp of opulence and empire before a real change is about to occur.
The war was still several years away from its conclusion, but by the summer of 1778, the British Army left the state of Pennsylvania, never to return. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Traditional dance groups and organizations in Philadelphia are giving immigrant children the space and support to learn about their culture. WHYY's Emily Neal has more on how these classes teach movement, spark creativity, and foster identity and belonging.
Charisse Luna Cruz twirls her long, colorful skirt and follows behind her teacher. She's at the practice for Nushakun, a Mexican folkloric dance group for children. When the 16-year-old started classes 2 years ago, it wasn't just the dance movements that were new to her. She also wasn't as confident speaking and understanding Spanish, the language of instruction.
At first, I didn't want to go because, like, I was new to learning about my culture because my parents never really talked about being Mexican at home. So I always thought I was just American because I was born in Pennsylvania, which is the United States.
But Luna Cruz says these days she speaks Spanish confidently. She also knows more about Mexico, especially the regions of Puebla and Oaxaca, where her mother and father are from.
Now I consider myself a proud Hispanic person, proud Mexican from Mexican parents, and I'm not ashamed to say that.
Pallavi Chakravorty is a professor at Swarthmore College and a dancer and choreographer of Kathak, a major Indian classical tradition. She says immigrant dance groups can be transformative for children.
I myself did not realize that dance could actually do so much, but I'm just seeing the way people are now wanting to connect to it, you know, and wanting something concrete and tangible to hold on to so that they can feel that they belong somewhere and launch their love and critique from that place.
Sinta Panyami Storms, an Indonesian dance teacher in Philadelphia, says her classes are a way for first-generation immigrants to explore cultural heritage.
In my class, we talk about why we do this dance a certain way. Why do we wear certain costumes? What is the story behind the dance? So we don't just come and dance, but we talk about like the Indonesian values, Indonesian philosophies. And I think they really appreciate that.
Gabrina Rizky Jalo started taking Panyami Storm's classes when she was just 8 years old. Now, at 20, she continues to dance and takes pride in her identity.
I'm glad that America hasn't washed off my ethnicity because of the community I am in and because Sinta has been promoting, making a space for us to practice our own ethnicity and our culture.
Panyami Storm says the art form helps ignite resilience for immigrant communities at a time when, she says, just existing is a political stance.
And I think a lot of times when we're scared, we're home, we don't want to leave our safety net. But building community is super important also to know that you're supported, that you're not alone in facing any of this.
For Luna Cruz, her dance community with Nyusha Kun also helps her imagine a brighter future.
I know that in Mexico there's a theater. I forgot the name, but our teacher always tells us that one day one of us can make it there. And that's what keeps me going, because I want to make it there too.
Emily Neal, WHYY News.
There is a little Yiddish renaissance happening in West Philly, thanks to groups like Shtetl Philly and Philly Yid, as well as weekly klezmer performances at the Ethiopian restaurant Abyssinia. Collectively, the organizations host workshops, concerts, dance recitals, and conversations using the Yiddish language to help people rediscover their Yiddish roots.
Shtetl Philly is a collective of artists and Yiddishists. The main thing that we do is we put on Yiddish culture workshops and events, and our thing is that it's community-driven and peer-led. So anyone who is part of the community can sort of come to us with an idea.
I taught a Yiddish theater workshop where we were taking scenes from a book and adapting them into theatrical scenes. Maddie taught a dance workshop.
We had klezmer variations for instrumentalists. You know, I have grandparents whose parents spoke Yiddish, and it was always in the background. I didn't know there was this whole culture attached to it. Like, I knew about the language and I knew about the music, but the culture was really lost or, you know, intentionally forgotten.
Ashkenazi Jews, which is, means it's Jewish music, but it's also diaspora music.
There's no one place where Yiddish is from. It's from a huge range of places with different practices. What's happening now is there's people who are falling in love with Yiddish culture, and they're trying to build experiences and opportunities for people to be in a Yiddish cultural playground.
Nitzuch mich fut die mir zu grinen, gefinst mich dort in nit mein Schatz. Wo Lebenswelk in bei Maschinen, dorten is mein Ruheplatz. Dorten is mein mein Ruheplatz.
I am one of the organizers of Philly Yid, which is a local Yiddish conversation group. Every other Sunday, we gather, usually right here at these tables, and we just talk in Yiddish for as long as we want to, which is usually a few hours. Between Philly Yid and Shtetl Philly and the klezmer scene, it's like a renaissance, a little Yiddish renaissance happening in Philly.
Thanks for joining us for The Source, powered by WHYY News in Billy Penn. We leave you with a Billy Pennism, a bit of wit and wisdom from Pennsylvania's founder, William Penn.
Men must be governed by God, or they'll be ruled by tyrants.
The Source is a production of WHYY News. I'm your host, Kenny Cooper. Our executive producer is Sarah Glover, WHYY's Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Our editor is Mark Eichmann, WHYY's News Director. Alan Tu is our audio editor. Our engineers are Charlie Kyer and Diana Martinez. Funding for this podcast has been provided by WHYY and the Linfest Institute for Journalism. Please rate and review this content wherever you get your podcast and share on social media. Visit WHYY.org for more news stories. Thanks for listening.